Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi everyone, and welcome to Confessions of a Debut Novelist with me, your host, Chloe Timms. This week, I'm talking to Olivia Ford about her commercial novel, Mrs. Quinn's Rise to Fame. Olivia was raised in Lincolnshire and now lives in London, and has spent the last 10 years in entertainment TV, most recently as a story producer. Her novel began life on a Faber Academy course, and in 2021, Olivia was longlisted for the Women's Prize Trust's Discoveries Prize. In this episode, we discuss using real people as a starting point for creating characters, her tips for finishing a novel when you work full-time, and how to balance writing an uplifting novel when you also want to deal with sadder and more serious subjects as well. But first, here's Olivia with an excerpt from Mrs. Quinn's Rise to Fame.
She gave examples of her most successful bakes in each category, rating them instead by the reactions of her friends and family. Pies. Uncle Stanley's cherry brandy pie, named after my uncle because he was so enamoured by it that he had seconds, thirds and fourths, and then had to retire from the table bent over in pain. His gluttony was frowned upon at the time, but in retrospect, it was quite the compliment. She smiled as memories returned to her, each one sparked by a different bake. But the further down the application she got, the less about baking the questions became. Her pen ground to a halt, leaving a blot of ink on the page. What is your greatest ambition in life? In 77 years, nobody had ever asked her this question. She didn't think of herself as an ambitious person, having never excelled academically, achieved career success, or raised a family of her own. Until recently, she had never considered that great ambitions were something she could have. For once, she thought, I'll just be honest. I've spent my life being led less by great ambition and more by small victories. The perfect swirl in a Swiss roll, the smooth pink dome of an expertly turned out summer pudding, cutting into a baked Alaska to find the ice cream has remained cold. I would say my biggest achievement is my marriage to my husband, Bernard. It's our diamond wedding anniversary this year, and I love him dearly. However, while he is graciously settling into the winter of his life, I have started to question what I have done with my own. When my day comes, I stand to leave behind nothing on this earth, except perhaps a few recipes in my kitchen cupboard. Applying for Britain Bakes is the first time I've really embarked upon a great ambition, and I'm 77. All of that is to say, I recently realised that if not now, then never.
Hi, Olivia. Welcome to the podcast. I'm really happy to have you on with me today to discuss your debut novel, Mrs. Quinn's Rise to Fame.
Thank you so much. It's a real honour to be on your podcast. I absolutely love the podcast, and also I've never done one. So it's a first for me, which is very exciting.
Oh, lovely. Thank you. So I would love if you could start by giving us a little intro to the novel and tell us what Mrs. Quinn's Rise to Fame is about.
So Mrs. Quinn's Rise to Fame is about a 77-year-old lady called Jennifer Quinn, and she's a talented baker, and she's been married to her husband Bernard for almost 60 years, and he's settling into the winter of his life, but she's started to question what she's done with her own. And it's this quiet ambition which secretly drives her to apply to a TV baking competition called Britain Bakes. But as she steps into this whole new world on her own, she's reminded of a time before she met Bernard where a deep and painful secret lies. And it's a secret that not even Bernard knows, but her newfound fame threatens to make that secret resurface.
It's a kind of irresistible premise, really, because you've got this talent show which is kind of familiar to us in some ways. Also, it's not just a baking book, you know, you've got this darker layer, sadder layer underneath, which I think you handle beautifully. So we'll talk about that in a little bit, but I want you to speak about your characters a little bit more, because I heard that they were kind of inspired by your grandparents, is that right?
Yes, absolutely. So Jenny and Bernard Quinn are very much inspired by my granny and grandpa. They were the sort of backdrop to my childhood. My granny and my mum ran a business together, so they sort of shared childcare. And my granny and grandpa now live in my family home. So I spent so much time with them, and it's a relationship that I've observed for my whole life. And they've actually been married for 63 years. And they're really unusual. Like, they took us all back for their 60th wedding anniversary to the hotel in Windsor where they had their honeymoon. And my grandpa, like, still had the receipt of what they ate and drank. Like, they're really, their love is like an amazing thing. And that is what really inspired me. I just had to involve that sort of enduring love in a novel. It was so inspirational. And also a slightly darker side of that, which I am so worried still of one of them one day losing the other, because they've spent a lifetime together. And I very much channeled that fear into Jenny Quinn.
Oh, that's so gorgeous, that story of your grandfather saving the receipt. I mean, how romantic. And I think that really, that romance kind of comes out in your characters. How did you kind of make them different to your grandparents then? Because I think people are worried about starting with a real person and then kind of making them their own. Was there any kind of characteristics that you thought, okay, well, I'm going to change that to make Jenny not like my grandmother, or I'm going to make Bernard like this because I want to make him different? Was there that kind of thought process going on when you were creating them?
Well, the relationship was definitely inspired by my grandparents, but Jenny and Bernard are different people. And I was really lucky in that, and this hasn't happened since, but Jenny came to me as a complete person. So she was always different to my granny. And she, I think at her heart, Jenny's kind of worries about having never achieved something and never having had a family or a career or really anything that she's felt proud of other than her marriage is so different to my granny, in that she has had those things, that she was immediately a different person. Grandpa and Bernard are quite similar, although I made Bernard quite physically different. That kind of helped me see him as a different person. Bernard's very tall and he's got these big ears. And I think I do see them as actually completely different people, but it's the relationship dynamic which is quite true to their relationship.
Have your grandparents read your book?
They have.
And what did they think? Did they see themselves in the characters, or did they know that you'd kind of based them on them?
Granny saw a bit of herself in Jenny, but more in like almost her body language. Like, there's a bit about how Jenny rubs the duvet against her nose. And my granny does that. She was like, how do you know I do that? So there's little things like that. And grandpa always says, darling. So he'll be like, darling, da-da-da. And he always brings her a cup of tea in the morning and the newspaper. And so things like that, they will have recognised. I was quite nervous about them reading it because I've never said to them, I'm really worried about one of you losing the other. Mm. Obviously, it's just something that I'd never say. And so in the book, I think at first Granny was like, cool, gosh, like there's some real, that fear that Jenny has, it must have been quite difficult for Granny to read and Grandpa. I think it's something most people feel, but it's not something I'd ever been open about. So when I'd written that into a book, I don't know, I was quite nervous about them reading that because I also just didn't want to make them sad.
Yeah, like it kind of opens up that thought for them, doesn't it? But I guess people think about it all the time, but I'm a sucker for grandparent stories and things. I was raised with only two grandmothers because both my where grandfathers passed before I was when I was very young. So I had such a close relationship with both my grandmas. So it's like I love grandparents' stories. I just think it's so cute. And I don't have any grandparents anymore. So I'm always like, I always like feel like people that still have their grandparents are so special. But I want to ask you about the challenges of writing in the kind of the mindset of a 70-year-old, because I know your grandparents really well, and you've probably spent so much time with them that you've absorbed their kind of characteristics. But how did you make sure you were kind of getting it right and not doing like almost like a your version of a 70-year-old, I guess?
That's a really good question. And I, just to start by saying that the thing that gave me the confidence to write from the point of view of an older person was actually The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry, because that's one of my absolute favourite books. And I know Rachel Joyce wrote Harold when she wasn't that age. And so it made me think, actually, I was never really attracted to writing to someone my age. And it made me think, actually, I can give this a go. So I'm so grateful to that book. But as you said, a lot of it was observing my grandparents and their friends and thinking, what would they do? Because they don't always conform to the stereotypes of an older person.
Yeah.
Like, actually, Granny kind of can be the opposite of that. She's actually very quite, well, she's very young at heart in a lot of ways. So a lot of it was observation. I have studied their relationship without even knowing it for years, and their reactions to things. And so, as you said, that was a massive part of it. But the other thing which really surprised me is that as I wrote, I sort of realized that a lot of emotions that we feel are universal. So I wasn't always thinking, right, you're writing this as a 77-year-old, so how would they feel? It was in the back of my mind, but I think love, loss, grief, dreams, and ambition, they're kind of universal. And the epigraph of the book is a Delia Smith quote, which is, whilst bodies age, souls don't. And I've always felt that I have a bit of an old soul, but I also think I was writing the soul of Jennifer Quinn, not the body, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. And I think that's a lovely way of thinking about it. I think there's a tendency when people are writing older than they are that they overdo it and they kind of make people like really old. And it's just not accurate for a lot of, I mean, how many seven, my mother's in her sort of mid to late 60s, and she'll still shops in Zara, for goodness sake. She's not, knitting. And so you think that's only 10 years, 70 kind of 70 odd is not that long, not that far away. And I think when we age, we're going to be, on the internet and doing all sorts of things that the previous generation wasn't. And so, yeah, I think it's about kind of not thinking of them as old people, if that makes sense. So I think you got the balance right. And obviously having your grandparents around you really helped with that. One of the topics I have to ask about is Britain Bakes, because it might be inspired by a popular TV show. Why did you want to use that as like a centerpiece to the novel? And if I'm right in saying your previous career kind of may have helped you construct the kind of the reality of producing a TV show.
Yes, it was massively inspired by my I'd spent 10 years, well, just over 10 years in entertainment TV, not on Bake Off, although I had written letters to ask to work for them as a runner when I was really young and I'd never heard back. So I just had to make, so I had created it for myself later on. But yes, I've always heard that it's good to write what you know, because I guess that's what makes you have a sort of unique insight. So I naturally was drawn to writing what I knew, and I knew I wanted to send Mrs. Quinn on a journey, and it just came to me very quickly that it was going to be this TV show. But also, I think The Bake Off is, whilst it's an entertainment slash reality show, it has so much heart. I think the people that it casts on the show are amazing. They don't come across as sort of fame hungry. It feels very genuine. They feel like they've been approached to be on the show rather than approaching the show. So It's got so much heart. I always cry at the final. I was massively inspired by Nadia Hussein's speech that she did, which I always I used to watch to try and get me in the spirit of the show, where she says, "I can and I will," and she's crying, and it, every time it sets me off. So I just thought, this show has got so much heart. And I just thought, I actually can't believe it's not been written into fiction. And I have to tell this story. I think actually since there's been a couple of books on cooking shows and baking shows, but I just thought that this has, I can't believe it's not happened, and it needs to.
I was surprised actually, because when I saw your book, I was like, what? I can't believe this hasn't been done before, or not in a way that is a very kind of big book, you see what I mean? Like, there might be some books out there that I'm not aware of that kind of cover baking shows, but not in the way you've done it, where Bake Off is the center of it, but there's more to the story than just baking as such. One thing you do, which I really, really enjoyed, was that when you delve into Jenny's past, it's in we see it in fragments, and we often see it triggered by some sort of food memory, and a lot, I think, of your chapters are food titles and things. What made you decide to structure her history in that way?
The fragments of flashbacks came later. So my original draft, the recipes were taking her back to a previous time, but it was all over the place. So she'd be like baking something, and then she'd like remember this, and then she'd be baking something else, and then she'd remember this. And it wasn't a clear structure. And my agent Lucy, and one of the early drafts, said that it was a bit hard to follow at times. So she said, why don't you italicize the flashbacks and make them a thing that stands separate? And then I started, then she said, maybe put them in the same place in every chapter. So then they became something that was, I think, at the beginning of every chapter, if there was one. So actually that came through drafts. So that's why that happened. But the reason that I wanted to do flashbacks was because the thing I love about recipes, and we have a few in our family, are that they do conjure a person. And the Grandma Audrey's chocolate crispy cakes is my father's mother. We make them every Easter, we'll make them this year, and they're so simple. They're a wartime recipe, but we genuinely do have in her handwriting scribbled down on a piece of paper, you know, it's spattered with grease and chocolate, and she still genuinely withers when we make them.
Yeah.
So that's what inspired me to do the flashbacks, because I really wanted to tap into recipes and their nostalgia and ability to bring a person back.
It's gorgeous. I'm just thinking of my own grandma there. So it's so nice, because I think a lot of people have that in their family, where you have like handwritten recipes that are all splattered. And yeah, I can really picture why that would be such a evocative thing to write about as well, because it's so real. We briefly mentioned earlier that you do delve into a kind of darker, sadder subject, which I won't give away because we're not doing spoilers here. We're not going to ruin the book for people. But can you tell us about the kind of challenge of balancing that with the kind of the feel-good nature of your book? Because it is like a warm book, but it's not a fluffy book, you know. It's not a twee book. There is this darker kind of undercurrent underneath that's Jenny's kind of holding close to her chest. So how did you balance that with the kind of the sugar and the icing and all the rest?
This is such a good question, and one that I've like really thought about, because it's really hard to explain. But basically, I found that both sides really need the other. So if it was just a book about the sadder thing that happens, there's a lot of autobiographies that cover the same thing, and I'm sure do it much better because they're first-hand accounts. And if it was just a book about the Brit and Bake side of things, it would be very, I think, two-dimensional. So what I actually found when writing it is that it fitted together like it was meant to be. So it wasn't a massive struggle to balance the two, because I found that you really needed the relief of the baking. And actually, I write this in a book, but I felt like it was much like life. So I think in life, the sort of ordinary really does rub shoulders with the extraordinary and the happy and the sad. And I think you see people and they, you know, they might be doing something really fun, but actually there's a whole iceberg underneath them of pain that they've suffered. And I think you have it in Harold Fry, where he, you would just see him in the street and he's an old man and he's a lovely old man, and actually he's carrying this huge pain. So I think actually the cozy and happy side of things almost fitted in really naturally with this sadder story, because that's how life is. Like, those things often run side by side. You never have all of one or all of the other. I think I made sure that they both, the climax of both stories kind of happens at a similar time. So they're kind of following a very different but similar shape in terms of story arc. But yeah, in terms of balancing the happy and the sad, it genuinely felt a very natural thing to do, because I couldn't have one without the other. It was the light and the shade, and they needed each other.
Mm. Did you, when you came up with the idea for the novel, did both aspects of it come to you at the same time? Or did you start kind of writing one and then think it needs the other?
That's an amazing question. And they didn't come at the same time. So I started with the older lady, so Jennifer Quinn, having not done something for herself and having lived a smaller life, and how she was getting older and had this sudden burning desire to do something, because if not now, then never. I started there, and then Britton Bakes came to me and I felt really excited to write this. But very soon, I just knew it needed so much more and it needed some depth. And I knew she had a secret from Bernard, but I just didn't know what it was. And it took me, you know, that moment when you're like, it like makes you like really up and down emotionally, because you're like, I just want to get this and I don't know what it is. And it's so frustrating. And like my whole mood was sort of dominated by how this novel was going, which was unfortunate for everyone else. and I was like, I just need to work out this secret. And I met up with my friend, Fern, whose father went through a similar thing. I don't want to give it away. Mm-hmm. And it clicked. And I thought, that's it. That's Jenny's secret.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, the sort of lighter side came first before the sort of sadder side.
Do you think then that aspect, the kind of darkness, lightness, and trying to figure out what the secret was the hardest part of the novel, or was there something else that was more difficult to you?
It was hard, but I also was quite early on in the novel when I figured it out. So looking back, I'd forgotten it was hard. I think I said this to you before, but it's really easy when you've finished to forget the hard bits.
Yeah.
And actually there were, do you know what I think the hardest thing was actually finding the time to write. And when I was working, because I found it really frustrating. Like I actually, sometimes I was at work and I was like, why am I here? I need to write this story. And at weekends I was writing instead of socializing. And when I was socializing, I was feeling guilty. So I found actually juggling the time really frustrating. And I'd like read that people sometimes wrote 3,000 words in a day and I was managing 200. And I found all that really a bit challenging.
How did you get over that then? Because I think sometimes that can be really kind of debilitating when I know I do it, when I see people online going, oh, just smash 2,000 words. And like, I kind of hate them and hate myself a little bit, because I'm like, I'm not doing 2,000 words, and 1,000 would be a really good day for me. Well, how do you kind of put that aside and think, and you know, I'm still going to finish this, even though I've only written 200 words a day? Was it just sheer kind of determination to get it done?
Well, by the way, I also never really write more than 1,000. Like, if I do 1,000 a day, I'm absolutely thrilled with myself. So, yeah, I'm not someone that can churn out words. It just, that's not how it's, that's not been my experience. Do you know what? I was signed up to author Libby Page's newsletter, and she did an article about like finding the time to write and the challenges, and I just replied to it. And I just replied and said, like, thanks for this. Like, I really needed to read this today. I'm trying to write my first novel alongside working. And she sent back the loveliest message, just saying that she did this thing where she put appointments in her diary. And it would be like 2 hours on a Saturday morning. This is when she was working and writing separately. And she'd find 2 hours on a Saturday morning. And she'd put it in her diary as if it was like meeting a friend or going to the dentist or something like that. And she did as best she could in those 2 hours. And then after that, she was like, well, that's not what I'm supposed to be doing now. I'm doing something else. And I tried to adopt that a bit, because what I found when I hadn't made appointments with my writing was that I was constantly feeling like I should be writing and I wasn't.
Yeah.
So that really helped. So that's thanks to her.
Yeah, I struggle with that a lot. And I always think I feel guilty like 24/7 because I'm like, every moment I'm not writing, I'm feeling bad about it. And then there are times where I'm like, right, I've got time to write. And then I'm sure you feel the same way. You're like, oh no, but I've got to do this chore and I've got to send this email. And then the writing gets pushed down the priority list. And then you're thinking, oh, and I'm still not writing, and this is my day to write. And, you know, I had yesterday off work and I was like, right, do some writing. And then I was like, oh, I've got to reply to, you know, 11 emails first. And you just think it then stops you, because you feel like, and I still feel like this now, even though I'm published, I still feel like that's not as important as other things. And really, like you say, it's about making the time and thinking, no, it is important. And I do have to give my time to it. But I still think that can be hard, because I think writing can be the kind of dismissed a little bit. It's like, oh, it's just, you know, it's just a hobby. It's just, you know, it's the thing we do.
Yes. And it's almost, it's an amazing and it's a joy, but it can be quite, you are literally extracting it from yourself. So I think sometimes you like, I'm so bad for being like, oh no, I need to do the washing.
Yeah.
And I don't really, but it's because it's almost procrastination, because it's like, you know, it's actually quite hard.
Yeah. You know, it's going to be difficult. So I think our brains naturally avoid difficult things. And it's like, what can I do that's difficult and not difficult and fun? And it's like, not right. But I think that changes. I don't know about how you feel about this, where I don't know what your background is in terms of like, did you used to write when you were young? Were you someone that used to write kind of stories when you were little? Or is this something you've come to kind of later in life?
So I used to write stories as a little girl. And I always, when I was on holiday, wrote journals and things like that. But I never tried to write fiction until lockdown.
Okay.
So I always loved reading.
Changed your kind of schedule, or it just made you think, I want to write?
It changed my schedule. So what I'd done is I love books, and I never thought being an author was a thing that you could just do. It for me, it would be like saying I'd like to be an actress or a pop star, because it just felt like it's not the job that you just want to do. Like, it just doesn't happen like that. And I would never have thought that I could have done it, if I'm honest. So it was never like, I want to be an author. And I did attend at the Faber Academy, do this introduction to fiction, like 1 day course. And I think it was like 2018. I'd gone to that and I'd absolutely loved it. And I felt like a little seed of something, like, I really want to do this. But then I was at work and I hadn't had an idea, so I didn't really pursue it. And then when lockdown happened, TV stopped and I was suddenly not really working for the first time in years, because they just didn't know how to make TV in that new environment. And I had time and I thought, this isn't the moment where I can do the Faber Academy writing a novel course, because when do you ever have a couple of months? And it's such a privileged position to be in, to have that time. And so I joined this course, and that's when I came up with Mrs. Quinn, the idea of Mrs. Quinn. And it was an absolute joy and the best thing I ever did.
Yeah. I mean, I did Faber and I feel exactly the same. It's interesting how you talked about, you know, not feeling that it was possible. And I don't think until I did Faber that I did think it was possible. And then when I did Faber, I thought, oh, okay, you know, maybe I could get an agent, maybe this could happen. And I'd love to hear kind of what your, because I know you were longlisted for the Women's Prize Trust Discoveries Programme, and I believe you're the first person to be published from that group. Did that give you an agent? How did it all work? How did it change your kind of writing journey?
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Yes. Well, I owe everything to the Women's Prize. They're such an amazing organisation and charity. So basically, I think you'll know this, but the Faber Academy course, you at the end of it, you should have 15,000 words. At the same time, they launched, Women's Prize launched the Discoveries Prize, where you need to submit the first 10,000, and they were almost a similar date. So I was like, this is incredible. Like, this is meant to be. I'm going to actually have that. I'm going to have more than 10,000 words because I've done this course. So I knew I had to apply. And they're very like, they make it really doable. They're like, you know, I remember them saying, if you're even thinking about applying, just apply. Like, there's nothing to lose. So I sent those the first 10,000 words in. And I think it was in the spring, heard that I'd got onto the long list. And I still think that's one of the best feelings I've ever had, because it suddenly made me, it was the first glimmer of maybe I can do this.
Yeah.
Like, someone's, no one had ever read it other than I'd read some to my husband, but I genuinely had never read it to anyone. And I just thought, oh, they think it's good. Like, that was just incredible to have that feeling. And I didn't make the shortlist, but I got an email from Lucy Morris from Curtis Brown, who was one of the judges, saying, you know, you haven't made the shortlist, but I'd love to chat, because she really enjoyed the first 10,000 words with a view to representation. And I kept rereading it thinking, well, it was like such a weird thing packaged in, like, it was both emotions packaged in, like, you've not made it, but I'm really interested. I was like, this is amazing. So we had a phone call, and we just immediately clicked. And weirdly, as part of the Faber course, you have to write down any agents you think you might query in the future. And I'd put Lucy on that list of four. So I could not believe it. And she, so we had this call, got on brilliantly. She completely understood what I was trying to do. And I had no doubt in my mind that she would be the perfect agent. She offered representation and told me to take the weekend to think about it. I obviously didn't need to take the weekend, but I pretended. I was like, okay, I'll think about it. All weekend, I was like, when can I say yes, please? And then on the Monday morning, so keen, I was like, yes, it was great to chat to you, and I'd love you to represent me. So I was incredibly lucky in that then writing the rest of the novel, I had Lucy by my side, which I appreciate is incredibly rare and was the most incredible support. And the rest is kind of history, because Lucy's incredible.
Yeah, I don't think it's that rare, actually, because I have heard stories of people, particularly people who've won kind of competitions or found an agent through a competition. And I'm going to bang the drum again. Like, if you see a writing competition and you're thinking, I don't know, maybe I should, maybe I shouldn't, just do it, just enter it. Because, you know, the worst that's going to happen is you don't get anywhere. But the best you can happen is all your dreams come true, or something like that, you know. And I really think it's, and also sometimes competitions give you feedback, or you get even just get a chance to chat to someone in the industry, which is a lot more than, you know, the industry is so closed off, I think. And so any opportunity to kind of get one foot in the door is always helpful, I think.
Completely agree.
I was going to ask you, because I was going to ask you really about a bit more about your writing history, because you said that you didn't really write fiction before. So you haven't got any kind of other attempts at novels in the drawer. This is like literally your first book.
Yes, it is.
Amazing.
Yep. Which I listened to your Jenny Godfrey podcast the other day, and it kind of made me feel better that she was kind of the same. Because you do feel a bit like a fraud. Like it, this, you know, like it should have, I should have like five novels that I hadn't finished before I got lucky with one. And that hasn't been my story. And I actually think I'm going to find it harder with my second. I think I'm going to get that difficult part after. But I have to, yeah, I have to say I was incredibly lucky in that it was the first attempt at a novel.
I think sometimes though it's more about the idea than how many times you've had a go at it, and you struck gold with a brilliant idea. And I think it's great ideas like that are gold dust, and they're so hard to capture. But if you manage to find that kind of really exciting premise, an agent is just going to be like, I don't care what your writing history is like, I want that book. And you often, you know, I think it's quite useful for people to practice kind of, you know, the pitch or the one sentence or whatever, to try and get it down to that really juicy, exciting bit of their book, which is so difficult. And I appreciate it's so hard, but and it's harder when you have to write other books as well, because you at the back of your mind you're thinking, what's the hook, what's the pitch all the time. And we'll talk about that in a second, because I'm eager to kind of ask you about your next steps in your next book. But I'd love to hear a little bit more about kind of your publishing journey process, I suppose. So how's it been for you? Because I know it's a weird process, and there are days where you are quite, you know, excited about things, and there are days where you're thinking, I'm really nervous. How would you advise people who are maybe thinking or about to become debut novelists? How would you advise them to kind of deal with all the ups and downs of being published?
That's a really good question, and I have found it like it was incredible, and it was a bit of a whirlwind because one minute Lucy was sort of submitting the novel, and the next minute I'd got like a cake arrived at the door from my now editor, and an amazing letter, and it was just it was such a high. But as with all highs, you cannot stay up there. Like it's just life, isn't it? So I would say it's been like real highs and real lows. And you might just be like, why lows? Like the best thing ever's happened to you. But I found it, without sounding crazy, I got really emotional and teary about selling Mrs. Quinn as a product. I found that really emotional because she's actually incredible. It's a real personal thing. And I felt initially like I'd sold her. Then I felt like a huge pressure in terms of they thought I was like a novelist, and I know how to write this book. Like I've written one book and I knew how to write that book because I believed in that idea and I felt all the emotions about it. But it doesn't mean I can write loads of different books. And I found the whole thing a real roller coaster. So I would not worry if you feel highs and lows, because it's not that you're ungrateful, and even though the best thing ever's happened to you, it's still, you have to come down from the highs. So I would acknowledge that, firstly. But also, my advice would be something I'm still trying to follow, which is enjoy the journey as much as you can. Try and take it lightly. Because actually, you've written because writing is something you love to do and writing is a joy. And I think sometimes you can be taken so far away from the actual writing. You're just a person that sat at a laptop and wrote something they liked and they wanted to write. And that's ultimately all it is. And that's what I try and think of it as. And I think you can let so many other emotions cloud the actual pure thing that writing is. And my mum always said to me, you're doing it because you enjoy it. Just enjoy it. Just sit down and just do it, what it is at the heart of writing you enjoy. And that's so true. And don't let all the big shiny publishing things and the pressure cloud what's really at the heart. And just try and enjoy that the pure bit of writing, which is what got you where you are in the first place.
Definitely. I think so many writers I speak to say the same, is that the writing is what we're doing it for, and a lot of the business publishing, publicity, marketing, all that side of it is almost separate from what we do, and it's always best to just try and not ignore it, but just try not to worry about it and get on with the kind of the writing and the bit you enjoy. And I think sometimes when it becomes your job, and you become, like you say, you become an author, and it almost feels like suddenly the writing stops being as fun. And I think a lot of us need to kind of try and remember how to connect back to the enjoyment of what we had when we had that, initial spark where we were writing every day and thinking, I've got to write this book, I've got to write this book. And it becomes, I think, much harder when you have already published a book and you have that pressure. So finally, I'd love to hear a little bit about, I was going to say about that pressure, but I don't want to assume that it has been a pressure. Can you tell us about kind of what you're working on now, or what you're considering writing next?
So I'm going to be really honest and say that when I first got the book deal, it was a two book deal, and I do desperately want to write another book. And I had a deadline for it to come up with an idea, and I kind of maybe forced another idea where it was actually quite similar, but with just similar but different, because I thought I'd got a winning recipe. And they weren't sure about that what idea. And actually, I totally agree in that I just was like, oh, I could do another older person doing this, and it was rushed. And actually, I've since had a baby and decided that I just need to take a little bit of time to clear some mental space to come up with something that I believe in as much as I believed in Mrs. Quinn. I think you have to meet ideas halfway. I think you have to try and have an idea. I don't expect it to strike me like lightning, but also I think ideas do come to you a little bit too. And I'm waiting for the right thing because I really have to fully believe in something to do a good job of it. I can't just write. I'm not, I wish I was, but I was wish I was someone that could just sit down and be like, I did a Claire Fuller workshop and she can just write and see where the character takes her. Whereas I need to know what's going to happen at least loosely. So I am not writing at the moment. I'm kind of finding my feet as a new mum and enjoying that and trying to sort of be present and enjoy it. At the same time, I'm really missing writing. So I don't know what's next, but I'm trying to meet that next idea halfway.
That's so interesting, Olivia, and thank you so much for your honesty, because I think so many people will relate to that, and that feeling of, and also I feel the same in that I do struggle to just have that blank page and, not know exactly what to write. And I think there is a pressure of feeling like you've got to write all the time. And, if your brain is busy and packed with so many other things, where's the spark going to find room? You need to kind of almost give yourself, like say, the space, the time, immerse yourself in other things, great books, great films, TV, whatever, music, and try and find your way back to kind of creativity. And I think forcing it is the worst thing, because like you say, you end up writing something that has got no soul, because your heart's not in it. And that's kind of cliche to say, but I just think it's really true. And but I really appreciate you kind of being so honest, because I think we all often struggle in silence and don't talk about what, how hard it is. And it sounds silly to say, oh, writing's so hard, but I think people will understand the sentiment of what we're talking about.
Yes, completely. And I think it's not a coincidence that I came up with the Mrs. Quinn idea in lockdown when everything stopped. Because I suddenly like felt myself remembering things from my childhood and just it was like my brain had been cleared of space. And I was kind of in the moment more, and I just had space in my head to have an idea. And I think day-to-day life, it clutters your head a bit. So I do think there is something in just like letting yourself have the space to be creative.
Yeah,
For
absolutely.
sure.
It's an exciting time now, because we're focusing on your first book, Mrs. Quinn's Rise to Fame. And like I said, I think you've got a really lovely balance of the warmth, but also a kind of sad, a serious undercurrent, which kind of it makes the book not kind of twee and saccharine. So I'm really excited for to see what comes next for you and whenever that will be, after you've made a little bit of space for that creativity. But thank you so much, Olivia, for joining me on the podcast today.
Thank you so much. It's been so enjoyable, and thank you for having me.
That was Olivia Ford talking about her commercial novel, Mrs. Quinn's Rise to Fame, which is out now and available to buy. And if you'd like to support this podcast, debut authors, and independent bookshops, you can now shop in the Confessions of a Debut Novelist bookshop, hosted by bookshop.org, which I've linked down below in the show notes. If you fancy buying any of the books you've heard on this podcast, then the majority of them can be found in this bookshop. And if you can, I would really appreciate you supporting me, supporting the authors and independent bookshops by buying them through this online store. Thank you so much for listening. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Or if you've subscribed already, it would be great if you could leave me a review. See you next time.